Hello and welcome to Great Lives, words that might be chosen to describe our great life this week are fiercely competitive, aggressive, utterly masculine, hard, wired, tense, insecure, angry, clannish, primitive, instinctive, unsentimental, supremely talented, or as singer Bono of the rock band U2 said, the 20th century in a voice. He was modern, he was complex, he had swing, he had attitude. In case anybody hasn't guessed who that is, I'll ask my guest this week, Colin Murray, to tell me whom you've chosen.
Well, I thought up until you said talented, you were describing me. We are talking, of course, about Frank Sinatra.
Many listeners will recognise Colin's voice. Colin Murray is a well-known BBC music and sports presenter who's just joined the Five Live sports team. And why Frank Sinatra, Colin?
You know what? I can't place a time in my life when he appeared, but I can't remember a time when he wasn't there. So I've heard him from the minute I could hear right through until this very day. He's been omnipresent. He's survived all my stages of music through adolescence and the adulthood into working professionally in music. He's just always been there, and I've always loved him, and I could probably give you a reason why I love him. There's a group of singers from that era. I put Roberta Flack in the same list as a female equivalent, who every word that came out of their mouth was steeped in an honesty and a belief that it came from their very soul, from their very heart. And Frank Sinatra was that for me, especially when he did the bitter, twisted, bluesy, melancholic ballads. You felt like it was coming from a place where he had lived every word. And for me, that's so important. It's not about the notes you hit for me. It's about the simplicity and the honesty. And for me, he had it in bucket loads.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clowns.
That's a song so steeped in introspective and sorrow. It's one of my tear tracks, you know. It's one of those songs I'll avoid listening to in front of anyone where I want to maintain my reputation.
I can see, actually, Colin, that it's one of your tear tracks.
It just blows me away, that piece of music. Every word that leaves his mouth seems to cause him pain. It's a stunning, stunning piece of music.
To help navigate us through this extraordinary life, we have, from New York, Will Friedwald, described as the poet laureate of vintage pop. Will has written so many books about music, most germane to what we have to discuss, I suppose, Will's book Sinatra, The Song Is You. Will, what did you mean by that title?
Well, I meant it literally, in that Sinatra, as Colin was saying, you know, Sinatra doesn't just sing a song, he embodies it, he inhabits it, and he makes it himself. And so I meant that very literally. Sinatra, the song is you. He becomes the song. It's not just a bunch of lyrics to him, but it's something that becomes a kind of a slice of reality. Steve Lawrence, who's a great singer himself, put it very succinctly, that when Sinatra does a song, it's like a three-act play with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And Send in the Clowns is a great example of that. I mean, you really feel like it's, you know, your life or his life. When I think back to my life, I almost experience like the images he paints, and It Was a Very Good Year. I mean, it almost seems like I lived that more than he did, you know. And then I have to like stop and remind myself, oh no, I didn't really do that. That's just something I experienced vicariously in a Sinatra song. But that's how vivid he makes it. That's how real he makes it. It seems more real to me than reality.
But Colin, you can't be much more than about 30. Can you?
A couple of years older than
that. Oh, there we are. I got it right. Is he singing your life?
Yeah, I think so. He provides many things, really. I think he was sexy, for a start. For me, what excites me about him, as I became an adult and read more about him and found out about him, was just not only just the music, but how much of a free thinker he was, and I think how brave he was, and some of the decisions he took throughout his career, knowing what the end result would be. But people my age, like in Frank Sinatra, I mean, I think he's just, he's universal, he's global, he's timeless.
Let's start at the beginning, Will. When, where and in what circumstances was Frank Sinatra born?
Well, Sinatra grew up in Hoboken in the Great Depression. His parents were Martin Sinatra and Dolly Sinatra, and really it's his mother that was the big dominant force, and she was a midwife.
Yeah,
and
it was a bit undeserving for a midwife that apparently he weighed 13 pounds when he was born and had to be dragged out with forceps. Is that true?
That's the story. That's the story that he always told, and he has a scar on his head for the rest of his life.
He started with a perforated eardrum, and they actually thought he was stillborn. They ran him under a cold tap. So they were worried about him when he was first born. That was his introduction to the world. His childhood seemed to be surrounded by real extremes. I mean, he couldn't last at school. He was expelled after X amount of days. Well, I don't think he took a formal exam, did he?
No, he never. He started junior high school, and he only lasted like less than 2 months. And I think that for the rest of his life, he was very uncomfortable with educated people to a degree. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that he gave so few interviews, is he didn't want to come out as illiterate and inarticulate. But actually, he was incredibly smart mentally.
I said, Colin, that his mother was a midwife, but it is said by some that that isn't quite right.
Well, it is said that Dolly ran an illegal abortion clinic out of his childhood home. It's been documented in various books. I don't know where Will stands in this. It would seem to support. I mean, he was pro-choice, and when he switched from Democratic Party to Republican Party, he said he agreed with everything the Republican Party stood for with Reagan, but not their stance on abortion. That's what is said. Whether there's any truth to it either way is probably neither here nor there.
Will?
Well, Sinatra had a way of confounding any expectation. I mean, he never did what you'd expect him to do.
I think an overview of Frank Sinatra is Frank Sinatra did not have a centre ground. He had the two extremes. He had light and he had dark. I mean, there's so many examples. You talk politics is a great example of it. Well, musically as well.
Well, this is true. I mean, he once described himself as a manic depressive. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the music is all about the extremes. I mean, songs like All the Way, All or Nothing at All. I mean, as far as you can possibly go.
Let's talk about the music. Listen to this.
Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come on, fly with me, let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed once I get...
Tell me a bit about those early years, Colin.
His mother, Dolly, arranged a job for him as a singing waiter. So somewhere out there, when he went to collect his Oscar for From Here to Eternity for Best Supporting Actor, there was a couple sitting somewhere in Hoboken, sitting down to their dinner to watch the ceremony, who turned around and said, "Is that the guy who served us our pancakes?" But I've always wanted to know how important this was, because when he signed to Columbia Records, big break, early on in his career, there was a musician strike.
Yes.
And he released stuff during that strike that had already been recorded, so that must have been hugely beneficial to him in terms of the competitors.
There were different pop singers being signed to different labels at that point, and nobody could really make a proper record because all the musicians were prohibited from going into the studio. By the time the ban ended, and it lasted as long as 2 years, it was terribly detrimental to the musicians, because by that point singers were really starting to dominate, and that sort of is the spark that lit the explosion that created the sort of age of pop singers. And from that point on, the big bands started to go down, and the singers, led by Sinatra, started to go up.
He was, to my mind anyway, an extremely attractive young man in a winsome sort of way, and he put on a good act on stage too. How did he get noticed?
When he started to sing, even with Tommy Dorsey, girls started to shriek and swoon, and they started to yell and pass out and faint while he was singing. I mean, he just did something to them romantically and physically, and it provoked this sort of strong physical reaction. And it started happening, in my view, it started happening spontaneously. And then when press agents, like Sinatra's own, he had a very brilliant press agent by the name of George Evans, when they started to notice what was going on, they started to choreograph it. In other words, they would, whenever there was a show, George Evans would get one girl to start, you know, shrieking, or two or three, and then 300 would follow. And that's sort of what led to the Bobby Sox phenomenon. And that's what really got Sinatra noticed, because nobody had ever caused a reaction like that. I mean, as popular as Bing Crosby was, you know, women really liked Bing Crosby, and men did too, but there was never anything like that sort of mass hysteria that Sinatra caused. I mean, there were like riots.
He said himself, "I work with lyrics primarily, and I use the melody as a curtain, as a background. That's an extraordinary thing for a singer to say. Let's listen to Come Rain, Come Shine.
I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you. Come rain or come shine. High as a mountain and deep as a river, come rain or come shine. I guess when you met me, it was just one of those things. But don't you ever bet me, 'cause I'm gonna be true if you'll let me.
I was able to sing six bars without taking a visible or audible breath, he said. This gave the melody a flowing, unbroken quality that, if anything, was what made me sound different. It wasn't the voice alone. In fact, my voice was always a little too high, I thought, and not as good in natural quality as some of the competition. Is he being unfair on himself, Will?
Well, Sinatra always had this point, this goal that he was striving for, which was to make pop singing more conversational. When he sang a love song, he wanted to sound it like he was singing it to the person that he loved, and not just, you know, a singer on a stage with a microphone in front of him. And to achieve that end, to make it more believable than ever, he had this concept that he could make, that he could break down a song the way an actor would a soliloquy, which is where the punctuation marks are, or where, you know, you would naturally have to pause for breath as dictated by the lyric rather than dictated by, you know, how the melody happened to go.
It's the method approach to singing, I suppose.
Exactly. It's Stanislavskian singing.
Yeah. This is the smooth, the professional, the controlled side of his life. But on the personal side of his life, less smooth, less professional, less controlled. He gets married very early, Will, doesn't he? And
yes.
Mistakenly, probably.
Well, I don't know if Nancy would agree with that, but Nancy, Big Nancy, is still very much with us. So, whether it was a mistake or not, but it lasted 10 years and produced three wonderful children. And when it was over, it was over. And Nancy never got married
again.
Well,
it was over because he was serially unfaithful to her.
Well, this is true. I can't argue with you there.
The biographies I've tend to look at sort of describe Nancy as an episode, and then after 10 years, he, so to speak, puts her aside. But she did everything for him. Her first savings she put into trying to promote his work, and he just led her a merry dance. I think that was a despicable way to behave.
She probably got that money back with interest, though.
The money, though. And she invested more than money.
Frank Sinatra is a wonderful character, not just for the good reasons. This man of extremes throws up a lot of negative sides as well, and a lot of negative things. And I think that's why I'm so in love with him. He wasn't, by any stretch of the imagination, some clean-cut all-American star. And in fact, through his own design and through his inability to keep his trousers fully fastened, there are little episodes of his life, long episodes of his life, which are in turmoil. In terms of his first wife, he said he thought he was in love at 19, and he wasn't. It's a story I'm sure many people listening here will be able to identify with. And then he entered the most ridiculous marriage with Ava Gardner, a woman who was as unfaithful as he was. I thought it was a match made in heaven.
Well, there was certainly, it was like, you know, you've heard of fire and water. They were like fire and fire.
Yeah.
And who after Ava Gardner? Who was the next wife, Will?
Well, he went for a long period where he was a bachelor again. In fact, most of the famous, you know, the Capitol Records period of the 1950s and the really swinging Rat Pack years in the 1960s, he was a total bachelor and, you know, allowed to chase as many women as he liked. And then he kind of surprised everybody by marrying Mia Farrow. I think that was 1967, at the height of sort of the flower child movement. He went and married the ultimate flower child, and that was not a big marriage. That was not one that really lasted all that long.
But Mia Farrow was 21 and he was 50 when he married her, so that was his showbiz wife, I think.
And after Mia Farrow, there's one more.
Barbara Marx was married to one of the Marx brothers, the straight one. What was the straight one called?
Zeppo.
Zeppo. He married Barbara Marx. She never got on famously with the three kids from his first marriage.
A lot of stories have swirled around about his violence towards women, private violence towards women. I don't know what truth there is in them. What have you been able to establish, Will?
Well, if anything, it's more violence towards photographers, and reporters, and in general. I don't think it's gender driven. I mean, he was capable of violence, but I do not think he was sadistic or got off on, you know, hitting women or anything like that. In fact, 99.9% of women that had anything to do with him will say that he was the ultimate gentleman and was always, you know, very careful not even to use, you know, foul language.
Then where does the reputation come from? Who makes
Well, the reputation comes from, you know, somebody like Kitty Kelly who will put to, and not just her, but there's at least, you know, a half dozen of these, like, gossip-driven books, these pathologies that are... even when they're accurate, they're not always accurate, but they just are sort of collections of every nasty thing he did. And when you read 500 pages of that and you don't see the whole picture, then yeah, it looks like he did nothing but hit women and photographers. Well, of course, you know, he did much more than that. And most of these books don't even mention the music. Yes, these facts are true, but if you put it in the larger context of his life, it's a different picture. I mean, one thing that you have to consider, Sinatra was a major philanthropist.
Here's a man who... In this day and age, would have been taking pills every morning. It's that great quote that we touched on, the 18-carat manic depressive, self-confessed. And I think to be married to him would have been turbulent, because I think you either would have been sipping cocktails in a casino and living the high life, or you would have been coaxing him out of a dark room. And there's a great Mike Tyson quote recently as a manic depressive, and he said, I've either lived my life on top of a mountain or at the bottom of the sea. And I think that's applicable to Frank Sinatra as well.
To give a bit of a sense of the life at the top of the mountain, listen to this.
When I was 17, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for small town girls and soft summer nights. We'd hide from the lights on the village green. When I was 17,
Colin, movie making was also very important to his career.
His first soiree with the Oscars, it won a special Oscar, was The House I Lived In. This was 1945, and it was a short film that preached racial democracy, and that actually won a special Oscar. But as I said earlier, it was when his career was in tatters that film really lifted him up.
Mitch Miller, who was Sinatra's producer for a few tumultuous years in the early 50s, once said that Sinatra's career was really reborn in From Here to Eternity when he dies. That because he dies, it's like a sort of a penance for all of his previous sins, and he was able to be reborn at that point with that film. Yet Sinatra insists on being Sinatra at every given point.
His daughter, Nancy, said that the one thing you could say about her father was that he was always honest. Do you think honesty is an important part of what Sinatra was, Colin?
In music and film, and in how he conducted his life, and in how he wouldn't take the easy way out if it meant betraying a value that he had. Films, as we've been talking about, is a case in point. There was many talented directors who were on a communist blacklist, and he purposely worked with them, and he employed them, to the best of my knowledge. So yeah, I think honesty's right at the top of the list when it comes to Frank Sinatra, and it was in everything. I don't think he was the greatest actor of all time. I think he's one of the greatest singers of all time.
But if honest, Will, how do you explain the mafia connections?
Well, it's a very complex issue. Growing up in the Depression in New Jersey, you know, the local figures, and particularly in a time when at that point, you know, the gangsters were very much like anti-heroes that were sort of presented like Robin Hoods in the films of the early 30s that Sinatra grew up on. And I do not think that the mafia helped him. I think that the mafia really hurt his career because of that association. Although years later, he said that, you know, after he made it and started to slide in the period that Colin was talking about in the early 50s, he said that the only people that still kept giving him work were the mafia. And but to a vast degree, again, that's an oversimplification, because at that point, almost every nightclub in America was controlled by, you know, some form of organized crime.
this is the reason why I picked Frank Sinatra more than the music, because here's someone who I think rather lazily is branded some form of mafia hoodlum, communist sympathiser, and a yes man for American culture. He was anything but that. He was a free thinker who spoke up for civil rights at a time when very few people would have been brave enough to do that, especially at the beginning of their career. He was a man who, at a time when America was laced with this communist paranoia, was employing people who were on that blacklist, knowing what that would bring for him. And he spent decades of his life being pursued by the FBI on some form of witch hunt, and the results of which we got to read in consequent years, was best described by one lawyer as £14 and more than 1,000 pages of unsubstantiated complaints and anonymous letters. If you want to look for the real Frank Sinatra, read those FBI files online on the FBI's own website. And the only thing on that is he once told a lie to the IRS. He said he'd never met one person who'd met, and he said he had a fear of crowds when he was at his draft meeting, which is quite illogical considering he spent all his life playing the crowds. For me, he was a free thinker. For me, he was a man who stood with his morals. Even when he changed parties, he still stuck to what he believed was his own moral code, what he believed was right and wrong. There was a seed change between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party when he made that change. Reagan was a different type of Republican president. You can see political reasons why he made that change. When you look through his career, at one stage, the IRS, the FBI and the US Attorney's Office got together and sat in a room and knocked their heads together and looked through decades of files out in Frank Sinatra to try and prosecute him on any one thing, and they could get nothing. And it's this image of Frank Sinatra that unfortunately lives with him. If the FBI's aim was to smear him, they've done a very, very good job of it to this day. It's written in the American Constitution that there's no such thing as guilt by association, so therefore he's not guilty. The only thing he had was associations. One particular mafia boss owned part of a casino that he owned. And I'm telling you now, if you grow up in an area of intense poverty that is ruled by people outside of the law, you will befriend them. You will not face them as adversaries, because you won't be around long enough to see your 18th birthday. And his association comes from a culture. It comes from a lifestyle. And I thought he described it best when he said that, "I don't want to know them, they want to know me." And I think it was pretty powerless to do anything but.
Well, you speak as someone from Northern Ireland, so perhaps understand better than a lot of English listeners might how, if you're part of a place, a culture, a time, you are almost unavoidably tangled up in it.
If you grow up, say, for example, in a council estate in Northern Ireland, and at the time of Troubles, at the time of civil war, you know, your neighbour or your neighbour's neighbour or the person in the next street may be unknown to everyone involved in that war, and you're not going to go around and knock on their door and tell them they're doing wrong. It will be part of the culture that you're brought up in, and it'll be very closed off.
I can understand all that, and I dislike Frank Sinatra for reasons that have absolutely nothing to do with allegations that might or might not be made about the mafia or association with the left or any of that. I hate his singing. I was brought up in the 1950s when he was really beginning to make it big. And Frank Sinatra, to me as a child and ever since, just sums up, stands for everything I hated about the mid to late 20th century. His singing is slurring, crooning, winking, worldly wise, morally compromised. There's a degenerate sound to it. It brings you to smoke-filled bars, other men's wives. There's a sort of cynicism, experience, stale air, easy virtue, sleazy quality. It was the world of grown-ups with their cigarette holders and martinis that I so much hated as a child. And he doesn't sing the songs properly. He slurs them. And I wanted someone to belt out the tune that I remembered. And I used to think to myself, listening to him crooning away and Rosemary Clooney crooning away on the radio, "Now, why don't they play real songs like 'I love to go a-wandering along the mountainside'?"
And, the Happy Wanderer.
Yeah, The Happy Wanderer. He's the dark side of the 20th century, and it's musical.
Don't hold back.
Yeah, really.
I think you've sat on the fence a little bit. Well, I'm glad you do. I think music is there to be loved and hated. It's a music that's all right, that sits in supermarket shelves we should burn down forever.
I will admit this. He does what he does very, very well indeed. He is supremely talented. Listen to this.
I did it my way. Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way.
Actually, yes. I rather like that. Of course, Frank Sinatra hated it, didn't he, Colin?
He said it was the worst song he ever performed.
And he had a reason for that. And it was, if you listen to everything Sinatra had done up until that point, he never did anything that was all about how great I am. I think the man was ultimately, he's been accused of being an egotist, but I think in terms of his own artistic perception of himself, he was uniquely humble. And that's what Shirley MacLaine said when she toured with him. She was really surprised at how genuinely humble he could be. And to do a song, I mean, his whole thing that he was comfortable with was a song that said, I love you, or, you know, I need you, or something like that. And he would never get up there and do a song that was self-celebrating. That was really something that if he learned one thing from Sammy Davis Jr., who had a whole string of these sort of self-celebrating hits, like I Gotta Be Me and things like that, I think that My Way is sort of Sinatra going with the flow of the 1960s, as it were, and coming up with a sort of self-celebrating song, which he genuinely did not like, and he genuinely was not comfortable doing it. And when it became a hit, and he was sort of obligated to do it at concert after concert, he genuinely hated it, because I think he was a sincerely humble man and was not comfortable getting up on stage about singing about how great he was, even though audiences loved it.
Yet, ironically, I think it was this stage where he could express himself in ways that the stereotypical man couldn't, which was just reflected off stage. I think maybe that's why we all love Sinatra, men love Sinatra, because he was all our bad points, and on stage then he was all the things we wish we could be.
Everything we wanted to be, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I think when he was on stage, he was everything we wanted to be. Only when he was off stage, he probably was most things that we are.
Right, and a little bit more.
My thanks to our guest this week, Colin Murray, who chose Frank Sinatra, and to our Frank Sinatra expert, Will Friedwald. Goodbye.